Thursday edition of Locked On NBA. David Locke along with Ben Golliver. We come to you each and every Thursday. Love having Ben with us from the Washington Post. Ben, I'm going to do this to start the show instead of to end the show. You put out a weekly newsletter. It's really awesome. I love it. How do people get it?
Yeah, just go to my Twitter page, at Ben Golliver, and I tweet out the link basically every Monday. It comes once a week. It's free. The topics vary everything from the players union's response to China to how the Raptors are trying to rebuild after losing Kawhi Leonard to whatever else might be on my mind that week. So I appreciate you letting me plug it, and I get a lot of good feedback from it. So if you guys are interested, check it out.
A lot of those email newsletters are just terrific, so it's a good way to catch up. All right, I saw Philadelphia last night. You saw Milwaukee last night. Let's start on the Eastern Conference and start with Giannis. I think he might have been upset that people had other people that might win an MVP this year. The guy looks like he's come out completely obsessed. We saw him for his first preseason game. He played with more fire than I've ever seen someone play a preseason game, as though he had a chip on his shoulder and something to prove, and that does not seem as though it's let off at all.
Well, last week I was in LA with you. We were watching guys warm up pregame. I love watching pregame warm-ups and just see how guys approach it. Giannis has that crazy spirit that you're describing from 2 to 3 hours before the game. I mean, he's taking contact. He's going so hard. He's grunting. He's dunking on Milwaukee's assistant coaches to get himself prepared for a game. And the whole time I'm sitting there watching him thinking, he's doing this, and the Clippers aren't even going to play Kawhi Leonard or Paul George. There's just no let up in what he does. I was completely impressed, as always, watching Giannis in person last night. Not only was the stat line huge, like 38 points, 15 rebounds, something along those lines, 9 assists, and that's really been a changing aspect of his game this year, just passing the ball and cashing in a lot more assists, even than last year when he really evolved and emerged as a big-time playmaker for them. It's not only that stuff. It's just the winning plays late. Hustle rebounds in traffic. I think he hit 4 free throws in the final minute to help ice the game. He blocked a corner jumper on the final possession. I mean, he's just so locked in. And I think there's superstar players with talent. There's guys who can make the winning plays. They're the Marcus Smarts of the world who get credit for the hustle stuff. But when your superstar player is also the guy making the winning plays for your team, it's something special. I think that's why Milwaukee wants him in that Defensive Player of the Year conversation. And I think, like you said, that's why he's in this mix as a back-to-back MVP candidate.
You touched on it a little bit with the passing. We saw the 4 threes last night. How is he different? How is he evolving?
Well, I think the three-point stuff is still a work in progress. He'd be the first one to admit that. He's kind of been tweaking with his mechanics a little bit. He hasn't necessarily shot the ball that well to start the season. And so that's what's so funny about him, and it goes back to the perfectionistic tendencies that you're describing in terms of how competitive he is. He's looking at things like his shot mechanics and maybe his three-point percentage being a little bit lower, and he's saying, you know what, I'm not even in a groove right now. I'm not even playing that well. But you look at his stats, it's, he's top 5 in scoring, top 10 in assists. They have the number 1 most efficient offense in the league through Wednesday. So if he's not even crisp, if he's not even sharp at this point, a pity for everybody else who has to try to stop him. But I think one of the biggest questions for Milwaukee this year was, okay, their offense last year, evolved so much on getting to the basket, the drive and kick stuff. That's how their 5-out offense works. And at some point you wonder, will the burden stack up on Giannis? Will he still be able to do it? Will you miss a player like Malcolm Brogdon for Indiana, who's really, kind of skilled and key at doing that in kind of a secondary role? But I think so far they've done a nice job of, starting the season, getting the kinds of shots that they want. I think they can still get better play from some of their new role players, guys like Robin Lopez and Wesley Matthews. So I think the fact that they're not necessarily kicking on all cylinders, but they still have a great record and still have the NBA's net rating, I think it's kind of a message to the rest of the league that, the Bucks aren't going to be folding after that Eastern Conference Finals loss to the Toronto Raptors. They plan to be right back where they were last season and potentially go even farther.
Let's touch on the Malcolm Brogdon part of this equation. Malcolm Brogdon right now has a usage rate of 32%. He's about the 15th highest usage rate in the league. He has the highest assist percentage of anyone in the league. He clearly could do more than he did in Milwaukee, which leads me to believe he might have been more important. I talked to important people in the league, GMs, assistant GMs, advisors, guys that are really important, think, you know, that you would respect. And they all talk about Milwaukee, and they all make the same comment. Yeah, they're really going to miss Brogdon, as though that discounts them. Do you think that's valid?
Well, I definitely think in the playoffs you'd rather have Brogdon than Bledsoe. So I think that's going to be a talking point that lasts all the way into May or June. I did an interview with John Horst, Milwaukee's GM, last night, and he had an interesting take on this. I asked him about the Brogdon decision not to keep him because they had matching rights. So if they wanted to, they were in a position. They were not limited by the salary cap. They could have kept him if they wanted to and just paid the money. His response was this. He said, look, we had to weigh that against the potential benefit of what we could get back in a sign-and-trade with Indiana. You look, they got multiple picks back. If you remember back to last season, they traded a whole bunch of second-round picks to rent Nikola Mirotic at the deadline. They also traded picks away to get George Hill a little bit earlier in the season. So I think somewhat of their thinking was a little bit of a longer-term view. The idea that, okay, maybe they have some of the skills that Brogdon already brings to the table and they can cover for that. And what they really need is some more assets to kind of manage things going forward. But then he kind of closed with this, John Horst did. He said, look, in the NBA, we never talk about win-win trades. We never talk about how both teams can come out of a situation for the better. He's like, of course, you know, Malcolm can go and have like his best season of his career in Indiana. That's not going to be a shock to anyone, but we can also be really good without him. And John Horst told me, look, I miss Malcolm. There's no question. Like, it pained me to move on from him because he's such a great person, great locker room guy. But I think the Bucks are in a position where, you know, they can arguably say they can have a great season without him. I think for some fans, that explanation would be a little bit hard to swallow because you are in title chasing mode. But I'm curious. I mean, what do you think? Are you buying what Horst is selling?
You know, the numbers, as you point out early on, seem fine, but I think that's because of Giannis and then Bledsoe. You hit all of it. Bledsoe's postseason performance 2 years in a row is really questionable. And Brogdon is opening my eyes. I didn't know that he could do this much. I always thought of him as a compliment to everything. And so my feeling was a little bit that's an overpay and maybe they got enough back for it, or at least they opened up the door for other opportunities. And I'm now wondering whether or not he had a larger role than we realized, or at least that I realized. I'm a little lukewarm on Chris Middleton as my second primary scorer, but I do love what Bud does, where Chris Middleton's usage rate just spikes the minute Giannis goes out of the game and he gives him that 11 minutes a night. And maybe that's enough. If he's got those 11 minutes a night and Giannis has got the other 37 minutes a night, then maybe you can survive without Brogdon. It'll be interesting to see. I don't know the answer to it. I find the Eastern Conference, which I know we think is the JV, really interesting right now. Because I saw Philadelphia last night, and Ben Simmons gets hurt part of the way through the game. And they actually, they're incredible. I mean, out because of their length and a bunch of things. But they have a bunch of things that aren't quite right about them. They're 22nd in the league offensively in the half court so far. They've just avoided playing half court until last night when Utah got them in the half court, and then they struggled to score. And Ben, I discovered this one prepping for them that I thought was interesting. They only have one guy on their entire roster on Philadelphia who's hit more than one off the bounce three this year. And that's Al Horford. He's hit two. They don't have anyone on their roster who can put the ball on the deck, come off a screen, and rise up for a three.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating situation between Philly and then Milwaukee as contrast. I talked to Horst about that too. I said, hey, look, these last few years, the Western Conference storyline has been dominated by Houston's obsessed with Golden State. They're trying to knock them off. These two teams are circling each other, and they're really focused on taking each other out. He didn't want to admit that it's the same dynamic between Philly and Milwaukee, but to me it is. I mean, you look at the moves. Al Horford, you bring him in. I think if I'm Philly, because of that Giannis matchup, right, one more super smart defender to guard him. Flip side, if you're Milwaukee, you're bringing in a guy like Robin Lopez to, I think, you know, to a certain degree, always have big bodies to deal with Joel Embiid and, you know, Philly's other frontline pieces. You look at just talent, you know, just name recognition. I think Philly wins, you know, from the top down, right? But if you look at fit, like you're describing in terms of how the offense works, how the guys, gel together and how many three-pointers they can create and make, I mean, it's a very clear, nod to Milwaukee in that category. So You know, I don't exactly know how that matchup will shake out. I think, to me, a lot of it comes down to, can Bud make the right adjustments in the playoffs? Can Bledsoe step up with sort of the weight of the world that he places on himself, plus the expectations with the Brogdon factor? And can they just play their offense like they did for, you know, the first part of that postseason run last year? It's very easy to forget. They started the playoffs 10-1. They looked unstoppable. They ran Boston off the court. Boston had some fit issues of their own. And they were up 2-0 on Toronto, a really, really good Toronto team, right? So there are reasons to still believe in what Milwaukee's doing and their formula. And I can tell you, they believe it very deeply. I think that they sort of have this feeling like, okay, everyone's going to, you know, latch onto the bigger market stories, whether it's Philly loading up, whether it's the two LA teams loading up. And I think Milwaukee still feels great about its position. And I think, you know, it's easy to envision, once you get to the playoffs, Philadelphia's offense sputtering, right? I mean, could you get a sense for that last night when they're playing Utah, that this thing could go sideways in May?
I think so. I mean, obviously, Gobert has a huge impact. Embiid was 3-for-10 on shots when guarded by Gobert last night. Horford was 1-for-2, and Harris was 0-for-3. So, you know, Rudy has an impact. He bends everyone's shot chart and makes them uncomfortable. I'll give you a note also about the mix they're trying to find as we continue. Ben Golliver, Washington Post, with us Thursday edition. It's Lock and Golliver every Thursday for you here on Locked On NBA. Hour-long edition of Rejecting the Screen is out today with John Hollinger. So grab that one. They talk a lot of basketball. They also talk about John's route. John Hollinger with the guys Adam and Noah. Noah Kozlov, Adam Stanko, Rejecting the Screen. And also Duncan and Hollinger and Duncan show is up and out for you. Launches late Sunday nights or every Monday for you. Grab that one. Have you listened to that one yet, Ben? Have you grabbed Hollinger and Duncan yet? On the drive to the Staples
Center? Oh, yeah. No, I love listening to John Hollinger. I read every word that he writes. I mean, I think the level of knowledge and expertise, even before he was in the NBA, was off the charts. I mean, he's been one of my favorite guys to read for, you know, 10-plus years. And now that he's bringing, you know, that personalized info, it's just a different level.
So here's a note for you. Maybe John Hollinger would be proud of this one. In 14 minutes a night, when Al Horford is on the floor with Joel Embiid, he takes 2 shots. In the 25 minutes when he's off the floor, he takes 14 when Embiid's off the floor. So 25 minutes per game, Horford plays without Embiid, which is because Embiid's missed games, but he's not playing 25 minutes a night when Embiid's playing 36, right? So in 25 minutes per game without Embiid on the floor, Horford takes basically more than a shot every 2 minutes. And when Embiid's on the floor, Horford takes a shot every 7 minutes. That's not going to work.
Yeah, it was interesting. The other night when they played Phoenix, you were mentioning Horford's off the dribble threes. I mean, they get into a late game situation where they need to just gin up some offense trying to launch a comeback. And they wind up, you know, getting an off the dribble three from Al Horford from the top of the key, because I think he was their most willing shooter and a capable shooter in that situation. But it was very strange, because you go back to last year and a lot of the complaints were, hey, Al Horford's not doing enough offensively. He needs to exert himself more. You know, he's sort of getting lost in the shuffle with all these other, ball handlers. And I guess, again, you kind of talk about Philly's, you know, ceiling offensively in the playoffs. If you're going to Horford in certain situations for like bailout type shots, or if you're losing him because he's playing alongside Embiid and he's just, you know, not a, you know, a major part of the offense, I think either one of those extremes is unhealthy. And so I think that's the challenge for the Sixers coaching staff, is how do you find the right balance for a player like him? How do you keep the ball moving, spread it out? And then how do you also get some of these supporting guys to step up in a major way? I mean, especially a guy like Tobias Harris, I circle as being their postseason X factor, where if their offense looks great, he's probably having, you know, a good role and he's shooting the ball well and he's being efficient. But that really hasn't been his MO throughout his entire postseason career, going back quite a ways. I mean, he's just never stepped forward and been that reliable guy in those moments. And so to me, that's another reason to question them.
Interesting little things going on with both those two teams. Other Eastern Conference teams, by the way, last night, Toronto beat Sacramento 124-120. I find the East pretty interesting right now, and it probably will be less interesting as the year goes on, because then, as you like to call them, we'll realize they're the JV. But Toronto It's five and two now, maybe even 6-2 after last night's win. 5-2 last night after the win. OG Anunoby gives him another monster game of 18 points, 6 rebounds, 5 assists, 3 blocks. Pascal Siakam is not blinking as the number one option. Kyle Lowry still Kyle Lowry. They're a little, I don't, like, if you stop talking about how much they lost Kawhi Leonard, you might have to just decide this is a pretty good basketball team. They're the 6th best offense and 12th best defense right now. What is your thought on how legitimate what we're seeing out of Toronto is?
You know, I had a little bit of an epiphany right before the season started on the Raptors. I know some people were saying, hey, maybe they're going to fall out back to the playoff bubble, or they're maybe envisioning a worst-case scenario where they really take a big step back and they're blowing the whole thing up at the deadline. But you know, I started to say, you know, what's Masai's like real guiding philosophy in these kinds of situations? Remember, he had to trade Carmelo Anthony back in Denver, and his solution always was to seek stability by locking in the players who were valuable to multi-year contracts, and then trading those players or moving those players down the road when he absolutely had to, rather than rushing into, you know, tearing it down or really like, you know, a large-scale retooling effort. So you look at Toronto's summer, they give Lowry money to keep him happy, to keep him around and locked in. They, of course, take care of Pascal Siakam early with the max extension. And all of a sudden, they have a very stable core of guys who played together last year, who showed that they had great chemistry, and who were all bought into what Nick Nurse is selling. And so that's kind of where my epiphany came from. I said, look, these guys are not going to be bad. Like, there's a chance that they're not great, but they could definitely be somewhere in that good to very good range. And to me, that's what happened. And I looked at Pascal Siakam, and I talked to the Raptors GM, Bobby Webster, about this recently. I said, you just realize that, you know, the easiest way to move on from Kawhi is basically, you know, just elevate Siakam and everything, you know, runs through him and, you know, revolves around him. And he said, look, the best thing about last year's playoff run for Siakam was that he got to see exactly what it takes to win on that level every single day. And he said, look, Kawhi Leonard might have gone to LA. This is Bobby Webster speaking, but his legacy lives on with Siakam. I mean, this is a guy who's going to be able to not mimic everything that Leonard did from a, you know, an isolation scoring perspective and all of that, but from a mentality, from a work ethic, from a intensity, from a two-way mentality, all those kinds of things can hang on in Leonard's absence and can kind of keep this team going along. To me, I think a player like Siakam's got to be in the mix for a starting spot on the Eastern Conference All-Star team, and it's one of the better stories. I mean, kind of coming from absolutely nowhere, Masai Ujiri believes in him, and it pays off.
I don't know whether I'm throwing cold water on the Raptors or I'm just pointing this out, because I actually think this has incredible value. So I don't mean to, I think I might be throwing cold water on them as being Milwaukee, Philadelphia, or maybe even Boston. Their wins so far this year are New Orleans on opening night without Zion, Chicago, Orlando, Detroit, Sacramento. Sacramento might be better than their record. I think the India trip really blasted both Sacramento and the Pacers. But still, their losses are Milwaukee and Boston. So as much as we're excited and they seem viable at 5-2, we might want to cool a little bit of taking them up to the next level. But beating below 500 teams is a really good way to be the fourth or fifth seed in the conference. Speaking of beating below 500 teams and also actually beating Milwaukee and Toronto, the Boston Celtics have won 5 in a row. Are you buying this thing?
That's the one team that surprised me a little bit more than any others. I think that they've gotten back into the mentality they had a couple of years ago, where there's lots of energy, there's lots of togetherness. It does seem like they have that spirit about them. I think it's really fair to raise the types of questions that you're raising with Toronto, with Boston too. You know, is this team really built for the playoffs if they have to match up with Philadelphia in that environment? You know, is their spirit going to be enough, or do they just need to have more top-end talent? I've been impressed with Tatum to start the season. I think that he's had some really, really nice moments. And then Gordon Hayward, you know, had a career night the other night and is looking like, you know, he's right on that schedule where with those leg injuries, you know, you kind of get 2 years out and you do start to look, you know, more like your normal self. So I think they should be pleasantly surprised. But I do think your point on Toronto is well taken and applies to Boston. Like, Toronto got beat pretty good by Milwaukee. And Milwaukee, as we mentioned last week, was up 20-plus on Boston. So to me, there is a gap, you know, between the East top tier and these next teams behind them. And to me, both Toronto, Boston, you could probably throw Milwaukee in there too. to me, that's kind of the second tier that started to emerge in the East.
The Toronto Raptors, or excuse me, the matchup tonight that we'll have an eye on is the I'm for real matchup. We'll talk about it when we continue with Ben Golliver of the Washington Post. I'm David Locke. It's Locke and Golliver Thursdays for you on Locked On NBA. Anthony Irwin and Adam Matas come to you every Friday. That'll be tomorrow's show. Make sure you subscribe to Locked On NBA and catch it every day. Your 30-minute bite-sized look at the NBA and all that's going on. So tonight, Phoenix and Miami, which should be fun to watch. Both these teams have been great. And I got to be honest, I'm all in on Miami. And my answer to you, if anyone's wondering why, is I believe defense matters as much as offense. I'm the only person in the world who does. Every piece of data actually shows it to be the case. And Miami is the number one defense in the NBA right now. They're projected when the season started to be the number one defense in the NBA. I think they are the number one defense in the NBA. And if you're the number one defense in the NBA, you win close to 50 games. Like, that's almost guaranteed. And I don't see any reason why they're going to drop out of this spot. So I think they're legit. What's interesting is Phoenix is the fifth best defense in the NBA right now and the 10th best offense. I'm not sure I'm totally there yet. They're the number one differential in the whole league. It'll be interesting to see, but I've watched probably of Phoenix's seven games. I've watched at least five of them. They have been consistently terrific, Ben. They're focused. They're shifting on defense. They know exactly what they're doing on the floor. Rubio has them put together. Devin Booker's been great. Aaron Baines is a beast out there setting picks. If you watch them and you didn't know they won 19 games last year, there's nothing about watching them in the five of the seven games they've played this year that would make you do anything but believe in Phoenix.
No, and they've been really, really fun to watch because of that. I mean, the 180 personality shift from this group has been a brilliant, beautiful thing to see. I mean, year after year after year, you know, watching them was just headache inducing because they didn't play for each other. They didn't play together and they didn't play hard, especially on the defensive end. It was just about numbers. There was no system. There was no rhyme or reason to anything that they were doing. And all that structure stuff is back under Monty Williams. And I do hope it continues for them because it's been great. Going back to Miami real quick, you know, that's a lot of high praise from you for their defense. When you're, you know, parsing out the credit for it, is it Spoelstra? Is it, you know, Jimmy Butler as sort of their personality leader? Is it their new big man contingent that does not include Hassan Whiteside? I mean, how do you parse out the credit for that success?
So the first part is the give a damn factor, right? Like, just the give a damn factor. Mm. They have been a top 10 defense every year but one since 2009, right? So they just give a damn defensively. It's who they are. It's their culture. It's Spoelstra, and it doesn't seem to matter. So that would be the first part about it. The second is just the Winslow, Bam Adebayo, Jimmy Butler, the amazing James Johnson if he was in shape, the amazing athletes they have, the ability to get into you, the fact that they're going to I think they can switch it. The way they're using Myers Leonard and Kelly Olynyk just as drop bigs right now, and then using Bam Adebayo as a four, I think is really interesting. I think that the really maybe the biggest factor is the give a damn factor. Like, they just care about defense, and that's who they are. It's part of their culture, and they're going to be that way.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, a major storyline to me from the start of the season is when you have some of these teams that, you know, we might view as like quote unquote overachievers because they don't have the headlining star names, but they, you know, they do play well. They do play together. It's nice that those teams actually can hope and play for something because there isn't a Golden State Warriors super team that's going to come through and no matter what shred them in the playoffs. Right. Like, I do think that hope should spring eternal both in Miami and in Phoenix, frankly, you know, with both those teams. Because, you know, look, like, you've got a shot now. There isn't someone who's just going to make you look ridiculous and take away, you know, all your pride and your self-esteem, you know, if they want to just go out there and play hard and wipe you off the court. And I think that's been, you know, one of the nicer developments so far to start this season.
The other one, by the way, is that Hassan Whiteside, you made the point. I don't think losing Hassan Whiteside hurt them defensively.
Yeah, I mean, look, like his plus-minus stuff has always been really sketchy. I mean, his ability to track ground out to the perimeter and to do it every single night and to be bought in the culture that you're describing, I mean, there was so much tension there over multiple years. And you know exactly what Miami's position is on all these things. So you know if there's tension, something's not being done. And then in Portland, You know, their loss to the Golden State Warriors, I thought, was very illustrative of their entire, you know, season dilemma. I think Whiteside had 20-10, but they lose to a Warriors team that just outscrapped them, outworked them, was missing all of their star players due to injury, and still beat them. And, you know, Whiteside, you know, his team defensive impact on that night, even though he's putting up the box score stats, just wasn't there. And Portland looks lost and confused. They're looking around, pointing fingers kind of at each other, trying to figure out, you know, what's going on. And Damian Lillard's, you know, seemingly looking around, hey, where's my help here? You know, why aren't we, you know, where we were last season from a chemistry standpoint? I mean, all those things to me are red flags for the Blazers. And, you know, we'll see if Whiteside's a long-term solution for them. I think if I was Portland, I would be actively trying to trade his expiring contract and, you know, attach it to other things, whether it's young players, draft picks, to find a different answer at the four or the five, because they did lose Zach Collins to a shoulder injury, and because they're waiting on Yusuf Nurkic still to come back from his leg injury.
Zach Collins' injury is mammoth to them. They've been so healthy. That is a big blow to them.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, just for their long-term planning too, like, I didn't think he was looking that great to start the season. I do think that maybe the local media there in Portland got a little bit too excited with a player like Zach Collins, or with Anfernee Simons in terms of the hype machine. They just got a little bit ahead of themselves. But, you know, when you lose, you know, key wing defenders at that 3-4 spot, you know, from the summer, and you don't really replace them with high level talents, you need every man, especially a guy who's got, you know, lottery pick type pedigree and potential, you know, going forward. I mean, this was a huge developmental year for him, and now it winds up being lost time.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if you remember our conversation we had about my numbers, I did not like that team, kind of uncomfortably, right? I had them, I think it's 13th or 14th in the West. The Zach Collins injury skews it a little bit the other direction. Other games that you'll catch tonight, Portland is at LA playing the Clippers. Kawhi will play. Miami Phoenix is that interesting one we talked about. OKC is playing San Antonio. Boston is Charlotte is the Kemba Walker Charlotte reunion. By the way, one little statistical note for you to keep an eye on. Celtics defense has been terrible with Kemba Walker on the floor this year. So that's, I think, one to keep a little bit of an eye on. Dallas snuck another one out last night. Have you seen much of them? They win at 107-106 against Orlando. Orlando cannot score, but somehow got 106 points last night. Have you seen Dallas? And I know the hype around them is awesome because of Kristaps and because of Luka, and we should be excited in that regard. But have you seen enough of them to know how good you think they are? Playoff team, competitor, where do you slot them right now 10% of the way through?
Right. So I draw the line between I'm all in on the Luka hype completely. I think he's been sensational. He was my most improved player pick to start the season. I'm feeling really good about that. It just looks like he's taken a huge leap. His body, it looks great, but he hasn't lost the physicality stuff. Like when it comes to rebounding, the playmaking and passing has been phenomenal. They definitely upgraded the talent around him a little bit, which helps him because he's got great vision, great feel, and he's getting the most out of them. In terms of the playoff question, I'm not ready to go there yet. You look at their schedule, it's been a little bit soft to start, and I still want to see more consistent production from Porzingis. I think, to me, he's still trying to get his legs a little bit after the long layoff. And if they're going to really be a playoff team in the Western Conference, like, he has to play like a star too. Like, he has to be that clear-cut number two star guy. And so that's sort of how I delineate. But how are you feeling on them?
So, I mean, Rick Carlisle's got them rolling offensively right now, and I think their depth is a lot better than people realize. Dwight Powell and some of these guys are better. The one thing on Kristaps, and I know he's coming back from the knee injury, but it's the same thing that happened to him at the end of New York. People have forgotten that before he had a knee injury in that third year, he did not take the third-year jump like everyone expected. He actually got less efficient offensively. He was not going to the rim. He had really stopped going to the rim. I think he only took 18% of his shots at the rim in his third year in the NBA. I'm all understanding that coming off an ACL, that is going to be a difficult thing for him. But at 7'3", I need him to get around and on top of the rim a little bit more than he does. Right? I'll give him a pass for now, but it was a red flag before the injury, and I need to see it before, as the season goes on, if that makes sense. In other words, he's just too good a player to be taking most of his shots as these mid-range kind of little. He takes over 50. His last year in New York, he took 58% of his shots as mid-range shots. Fine, he's good at it, but you can't live that way. He shot 42% on those shots. That's not an efficient offensive player, and I'm curious to see I'm just guessing I'm not all in on Kristaps like everybody else is. People have forgotten because of the knee injury that his third year in New York was not good.
Yeah, it was such a weird year because remember he started out sensationally for that first month, and then you know he relapsed. I think maybe it's fatigue factor or what you want to chalk it up to, but he did relapse maybe into some some poor habits there or poor shot selection or maybe not even poor but just worse. I don't mind him taking those mid-range shots if it's a late clock situation because he's able to get a turnaround on anybody. So, you know, it's better than, you know, some of the alternatives. But yeah, like I agree for sure. And I just don't think he's necessarily moving and sustaining energy to the degree that he needs to. So that's why I consider both him and their team as a whole open questions. But I mean, are you with me on Doncic at least?
I feel like he's been so good,
right? And like the hype is so deserved that way. If you're a Mavericks fan and you've been waiting for anything to cheer about, basically since they broke up that 2011 title team, I think if you're a Mavericks fan, you almost like turn a blind eye to Porzingis and just say, you know what? All I'm going to do is watch Luka when he gets on the court. I mean, he's that level of captivating and that level of going forward, like, you know, awe-inspiring, hope-inspiring for that franchise.
It's interesting. Last draft, that draft class is obviously turning out to be terrific. This draft class might be turning out to be better than people think. Maybe these kids are readier, more ready than we think when they come in the league. We'll talk about that in upcoming weeks. He's Ben Golliver. We'll be back with you next Thursday. Anthony and Adam are with you tomorrow. And then remember, every Monday is Josh Lloyd with the local experts on the biggest stories. It's Locked On NBA. It's your daily 30-minute bite-sized podcast on the NBA. Grab it. Subscribe to it. Follow it on your preferred podcast provider and be a part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Thanks to Ben Golliver. Subscribe to his newsletter for the Washington Post. You can get it on his Twitter feed. He has the link there for you. I'm David Locke. Have a great day. Rejecting the Screen with John Hollinger should be your next stop. In fact, just tell your smart device, play the most recent episode of podcast, Rejecting the Screen. Have a great one.